that can execute that many people is a pretty good go-to source for efficiency. Excuse me. Volrach was halfway to his desk, but stopped cold. Hmm? Frank looked up as if confused. Did I say something? I did not execute anybody. Volrach protested. Of course not, said Frank. I'm just saying that the people who trained you did. And by all accounts, they were pretty damn good at it, and whatever organizational prowess made that possible must have rubbed off at some point. He looked at Chuck. Did you know they found entire crates full of wedding rings in some of those death camps? Entire crates! You could just sift your hand through them. Frank, said Ostertag, but Frank ignored him. I mean to kill that many people and dispose of all of their bodies and then still save all their stuff is just impressive as hell is all I'm saying. Frank! Ostertag shouted, and Frank finally stopped. Bettina smiled from her doorway, though it looked more strained than cheerful.
Chief Davis would like to announce that we are all invited to a celebratory meal at Richardhof for lunch. He is buying.
The cabin was silent for a moment, and then Frank nodded again. Good. Great. That sounds like fun. He looked back at his work. Congratulations again, Yannick. That's great. The rest of the morning passed like that, tense and quiet and filled with uneasy looks. Reed tried not to make eye contact with anyone, but Chuck caught his eye once with a look that meant what? Probably that he was worried. Reed couldn't argue with that. Who wouldn't be? By the time lunch finally rolled around, the mood had calmed, and Frank chatted amiably with Reed as they walked together to Richardhof, a beer garden that claimed to have been around since 1464. A lot of places in Germany were like that, but only some of them had survived the war. This neighborhood, called Neukölln, had survived much better than the actual city of Köln, which had lost everything but its cathedral, and that only survived because the Allied pilots had used it for navigation. Reed tried not to think of the destruction of life, of infrastructure, of history itself. Most people didn't. It was numbing after too long, and all you could really do was move on. Europe had bars like Richardhof, so old they'd been serving beer for two generations before the people drinking in them had gotten up and sailed across the sea and settled Reed's continent. The sense of time here was so different to him it felt alien, and it had all been wiped away. Frank talked about baseball, his usual obsession, but the conversation felt strained to Reed. More determinedly cheerful, like Frank was trying to force it. So Whitey Ford goes out there, Frank was saying, Game 4, World Series, and just blows them away. You have no idea. Strike after strike. You've never seen a pitcher this good. Reds didn't know what hit them. They reached the antique building and Reed held the door while his co-workers filed through it. Bettina had called ahead for a table and Davis gestured to it. Lunch is on me. He winked. And so is the booze. There was a general cheer from the officers as they all found seats and the server began taking orders. Reed ordered Molotaschen, which was basically German ravioli. And there was another round of laughter.
It's not Easter, said Volrach.
Maybe he's Schwäbisch, said Gisela with a smile.
Are these just an Easter thing? Asked Reed.
They're wonderful. Why would you only eat them at Easter?
And why would you only eat roast turkey at Thanksgiving? Asked Ostertag.
We eat turkey all year, said Reed.
Not roast turkey, said Chuck. Not with dressing and gravy and cranberry sauce.
Look, said Reed, it's on the menu.
But Volrach only laughed and slapped him on the back.
Order what you want, said Chuck. In fact, you know what?
He looked at the server.
Molotashin for me, too. I love those little bastards. The others made their orders. Schweinebraten and Weisswurst and Rouladen, rich meats and potato salad, the German kind, mixed with vinegar instead of mayonnaise, though Reed had never quite gotten used to it. The first round of beer appeared, and Davis offered a toast to Wohlreich, wishing him luck with his new job.
Prost,
said the officers, and even Frank joined in. Alcohol was the great equalizer, and Davis knew what he was doing in presenting it as a peacemaker to soothe the cabin's nerves. As the lunch wore on, though, Reed began to realize that Davis knew what he was doing in much darker ways. A lunch party gave Frank a chance to get more and more inebriated, raising the chances that he would say something more about Wohlreich's past and bring the argument out into the public where other people could see it, hear it, and spread rumors about it.
I'm thinking of getting a cat, said Gisela, cutting a bite of meat from the corner of her Schweinbraten.
Pass the wine, please, said Reed, and Gisela handed the bottle across the table.
A cat? Asked Lisa. I love cats. What kind?
Orange, said Gisela. It doesn't matter what breed. I just want a cat.
I'm more of a dog person, said Frank. Wine?
Reed handed him the bottle and took another bite of his salad. Too much vinegar.
A dog is a simpleton, said Wohlreich. A cat doesn't need you or maybe even want you. And that's what makes them interesting.
Wine, said Wagner.
Frank passed it toward him.
Hand this back when you're done, okay, Harold? I need a little more.
Wagner took the wine and grunted.
Do you build all of your relationships that way?
Asked Ostertag, looking at Wohlreich with a sly grin.
With women, perhaps? You only love the ones that do not love you back?
A woman is not an animal, said Wohlreich.
You're saying the wrong ones, said Ostertag.
Wagner glared at him and passed the wine bottle back to Frank.
Save some for the rest of us, huh, Frank?
Chuck held out his wine glass, wiggling it slightly in front of Frank's face.
Frank poured him some and then poured a little more for himself.
I had a dog when I was a boy, said Davis, setting down his fork.
And two cats.
And 200 head of cattle.
Though I only named one of them.
You grew up on a farm? Asked Reed.
Ranch, said Davis, Wyoming.
Please tell me that you named her Bessie, said Ostertag.
Tulip, said Davis.
Some wine, Frank? Frank poured Davis a serving, then another for himself.
I didn't know people named cows, said Lisa.
Most people don't, said Davis. I learned why when we slaughtered Tulip for steaks in the winter.
Lisa's eyes went wide.
She was your pet.
Davis shrugged.
We were hungry.
Pass the wine, said Wohlreich.
We never had a cat when I was a kid, said Frank. But there was a neighborhood cat, like an alley cat, who came around from house to house and purred for food. I used to set out a little saucer of milk for her every night at dinner. Drove my mother nuts.
The wine, said Wohlreich.
Frank reached across and poured him a tiny splash.
We had a name for it, all the neighborhood kids.
We called it Moshe.
A little more,
said Wohlreich, and suddenly Frank whirled on him, eyes fierce with irritation.
What is it with you and the wine, huh?
You're the one who has drunk half the bottle, said Wohlreich.
Oh, I'm sorry,
said Frank, in a voice that sounded anything but.
Am I taking more than my share?
Not a great start to the Wohlreich regime. I apologize.
He reached out with the bottle and poured it into Volreich's glass, far more than was proper, filling the glass to the top until it curved up above the rim, jiggling slightly, held in place by nothing but a weak, cohesive force.
"You're drunk," said Volreich.
Reed almost reached out, almost put his hand on Frank's shoulder, almost said, "Easy there, buddy, calm down," but he didn't. He had to let this happen.
"Believe it or not, there are some things you're still not in charge of," said Frank, and poured the dregs of the bottle into his own glass.
"Sorry."
"Come on," said Chuck, filling in where Reed would not.
"Everyone, just take it easy, okay?"
Frank drained his entire glass, maintaining eye contact with Volreich the entire time.
"Frank," said Chuck.
But Frank turned on him now, snapping out a question like a knife strike.
"How many of your family died in the war?"
"My uncle," said Chuck, taken by surprise. "Two of my cousins on the other side. My school teacher.
Soldiers.
Everyone."
"Then how can you sit here," said Frank, "and drink wine and talk about cats with the same damn Nazis who killed them?"
"Mr. Schwartz," said Davis sharply.
"They've changed," said Chuck. "We have to do the same."
"Easy for us to say,"
said Frank, and pushed his chair back from the table.
"We're the ones who lived."
He stood up and walked away. Reed looked at his food, tapping it uncomfortably with his fork in the heavy silence that hung over the table. After a moment, he looked up and saw that most of the cabin officers were doing the same, avoiding each other's eyes while they picked at their potato salad or peered into the corners of the room. Lisa caught his eye, holding it for longer than Reed expected, before looking away again. Gisela was the first to speak.
"You were only a child in the war," she said, looking at Volreich. "We all were. I was a Wehrmacht officer."
"Only because all the adults were dead," she said. "You were a boy of 19.
Volreich looked ready to speak again, but Davis spoke with an air of finality.
"We've all been people we didn't want to be. I assembled this team because I trust who you are today. Who you were 15 years ago doesn't matter."
Volreich closed his mouth, and they finished the meal in quiet contemplation. Reed couldn't help but run his eyes across the other tables in the restaurant, wondering which of the other patrons had heard them, and what they thought, and if any of them had been eavesdropping on purpose, reporting to the Stasi for Operation Talon. When they returned to the cabin, Frank wasn't there, though he eventually arrived about 40 minutes later. He smelled like he'd been drinking the entire time, but he didn't start any more arguments, instead working sullenly at his desk. Reed did his best to work as well, checking Ostertag's Mother Goose decryption numbers with his slide rule, making notes in the margins where he thought the figures diverged too widely from the conjectures Ostertag was attempting to draw. Most of it was sound, though, using a mathematical theory Reed had only read about and never used in practice, and,
"Mr. Reed,"
said Bettina loud in his ear. Reed looked up, startled.
"What? What's wrong? Did something happen?"
Ostertag laughed.
"I've been trying to get your attention," said Bettina, her cheeks coloring slightly. "You are very deep in your work, and I'm sorry to interrupt."
Reed looked at the clock. It was nearly 4. "Is everything okay?"
"A message just came in," said Bettina. "It's still coming, actually."
For all his nervous impatience in the morning, it now took Reed a moment to shift his mental gears and realize what Bettina was talking about.
"A message? A longshore message, of course."
He gathered his notepad and pencils and stood, stopping to arrange the other papers on his desk into some semblance of order, then picked up his notepad again and hurried after Bettina. Davis gave him the day's confirmation code, Q, this time. Reed stood in front of the large reel-to-reel recorder, watching as it turned in circles. At the moment it was recording nothing, it responded to radio signals, lying dormant until it heard something, and then recording that frequency for several minutes to be sure it got it all. Since the actual message came in tiny bursts, each separated by a minute or more, most of the tapes were dead air. An odd patch of static sounded softly on the speaker, here and gone almost before Reed knew it was there. He looked at Bettina. Is our antenna broken?
I think that is the message, she said. He's using the 3-second option. I almost didn't recognize it as a message when the recorder first started going.
Reed looked back at the recorder again, silently spooling more empty tape from one reel to another. It made sense. The RT3 burst encoder had a fast option, sending each cylinder in 3 seconds instead of 8. Longshore had never used that option before, but if he was sending this in the middle of the day where he might be seen, he needed to be as fast as he could. Was he sending from home, from the restroom of a bar or restaurant, holed up in the closet of a Stasi office building somewhere? Reed counted the seconds, imagining Longshore reading the code off a pad of paper and rapidly setting the sliders on the cylinder. At 52 seconds, remarkably fast even for Longshore, another 3-second burst croaked out of the speaker. At this rate, it wasn't even discernible to the naked ear as Morse code. 8 letters per second, with as many as 5 pulses each. He'd have to slow it down even more than usual to try to interpret it.
That's the 4th burst, said Bettina.
Reed said nothing, listening intently and counting the seconds. 55 seconds later, the speaker squawked again, and after another 58 seconds, it squawked a 6th time. Reed kept counting and held his breath when he reached the 50s. 58, 59, 60. No burst. 65, 70, 80. 100 seconds. 120. 2 minutes with nothing.
That's probably it, said Bettina.
Probably, said Reed,
but he let the machine run anyway. It would record for a full 5 minutes after the last signal it received, and he let it have the full time, not wanting to risk losing a burst if another came in while he was switching out the reels. The timer expired and the recorder stopped, and still Reed watched it, listening and waiting.
Mr. Reed.
Yes, said Reed, and picked up another reel. He took a deep breath, steeling himself to do it, and then switched the tapes, threading the new one through the machine as quickly as he could without doing it wrong. No more bursts. 6 bursts, he told himself. Standard message. 150 characters, down to 75 after decoding. He locked himself in the private room, set his loaded pistol on the table, and opened the safe. The next section of player piano was marked with a pencil. It now, sir, 10:15, I promise. Dr. Catherine Finch was his secretary, and the O. Reed scanned the rest of the paragraph, reading the next few lines. And the only woman in the Ilium Works. Actually, she was more of a symbol of rank than a real help, although she was useful as a stand-in when Paul was ill or took a notion to leave work early. Once again, Reed wondered what the book was about. Why did the man have a doctor as his secretary? What was she a doctor of? He'd gathered from the first page that the Ilium Works was some kind of factory, so maybe she was an engineer. And a good one, apparently, if she was able to do her boss's job every time he couldn't be bothered to do it himself. The rest of the paragraph seemed to imply that the world had become so automated that even a job as a secretary was scarce. Machines did everything. Maybe Lisa was right, and this was the future, and he should study computers as she was. He listened to the tape carefully, slowing it down and recording each dot and dash exactly. He listened to the recording a second time, double-checking his transcription, then triple-checking it just to be sure, then dove into the translation. Q. That was a good sign. O-P-T-A-L-O-N. Operation Talon. Everything was working smoothly. What would be the sixth word? If Lisa was right, it would be German. And another clue she could use to find message 41. If Lisa was a double agent, it might instead be a code phrase that her handler was using to send her instructions, and Reed was making sure the instructions were delivered straight to her. The thought made him sick. Or maybe Lisa was innocent and Davis was the double agent, or anybody. He still wasn't sure what to make of Wagner, and Ostertag definitely had his quirks. Could Chuck be the traitor? An American? It wouldn't be the first time. Davis wouldn't be using Frank as bait if the Stasi didn't have a history of corrupting American citizens. Maybe the Stasi had officers in the upper ranks of the CIA. How much did Reed really know about his superiors? A corrupt hiring officer in the CIA or BND could have filled the listening station with double agents. For all he knew, he was the only person who wasn't a traitor. Reed closed his eyes. These were his friends. Lisa was his closest friend, the woman he loved or thought he did. He didn't want to suspect any of them. But what else could he do? He concentrated on the message. O.P. Talon, Baker, Chandler. No, the S belonged to the previous word, Baker's handler. C.N. meaning code name. And then the sixth word, Vice. Operation Talon, Baker's handler, code name Vice. The sixth word was German, right on cue. But something about it didn't sit right. What were the odds that the exact German word Longshore needed in order to pass his secret message to Lisa just happened to be the code name for Baker's handler? Unless Longshore had known this all along and had planned his messages around it. Or Longshore was so highly placed in the Stasi that he could choose his own nicknames, and he chose this one because he needed it to make his code work. Or the entire message was a lie and Longshore was making the whole thing up just so he could put his secret code in the sixth word slot. Reed translated the rest of the message, and when he was done, he sat there for several minutes staring at the code and the tape and the door and the gun. Should he tell the sixth word to Lisa as he'd promised? Should he even show it to Davis? He had no idea who to trust or how to figure such a thing out. On the other hand, everyone knew he was in here. Everyone knew that a message had come in and that he had decrypted it, and that any minute now he would open the door, walk into Davis's office, and show it to him. If he did anything else, he'd be breaking the law. If he refused to share the message, he'd be branded a traitor, and rightly so, and locked away in a CIA cell. The wheels were in motion, and Reed had to move or be crushed. He put his things away in the safe, holstered his pistol, and unlocked the door. Wolrach was discussing something with Davis.
"Do you want me to come back later, sir?" Reed asked.
"Not at all," said Davis. "Come in." Close the door.
Reed looked at Wolrach. "With Yannick inside?"
"Yes," said Davis. "He's a sub-chief now, and we need another head in these meetings anyway. I've been catching him up on some of the details, and I'd like his thoughts on whatever message 44 has to offer." He put an odd emphasis on the word "some of," and Reed got the hint that Wolrach didn't know everything. He was certainly still in the dark about Frank's counter-op against Talon and his own unwitting role in it. Reed wondered what else the man didn't know and determined to say as little as possible, just in case. Reed closed the door, locked it, and sat next to Wolrach. He pulled the decoded message from his pocket, hesitated, and then handed it to Davis. The chief read the message in silence. Q. O.P. Talon, Baker's Handler, C.N. Vice. Eric Gunther Anselm. GDR to demand ID at border entry. QQQQ. It was Reed's biggest fear made explicit by Longshore. The East Germans were closing the border. By demanding ID, they were breaking the Potsdam Agreement, and from there, it was only a small step to a full military action. The Cold War was about to heat up. Interesting, said Davis.
Have you ever heard of the man he mentions? Asked Reed.
I haven't.
What's the name? Asked Volreich. I can ask Gisela to look him up.
Not yet, said Davis. I'll look into it myself. The fewer people who know the name, the better. Reed nodded. There was no guarantee, after all, that Volreich himself wasn't the Stasi mole. Telling him the name of another Stasi contact might tip him off that they'd already discovered Talon.
Should I leave? Volreich looked visibly frustrated. Whatever the contents of that message, you are clearly not comfortable sharing it with me.
Not the first part, no, said Davis. The second part I definitely want your thoughts on. Wally? You added all the spaces and punctuation yourself, correct?
I do, said Reed. Is there a problem with it?
Only that I think you've overreached this time, said Davis, tapping the message. You've put the name on a separate line. But if you group everything together, the meaning seems obvious. He showed Reed the words. Baker's Handler, C.N. Vice, Eric Gunther Anselm.
I'd considered that, said Reed, but then I thought...
Actually, he didn't know what he'd thought. He'd been distracted by the German word, but no, that was only partly true. Really, he'd been distracted by Lisa and his ongoing indecision. Should he tell her, should he not?
What were you saying? Asked Davis.
Nothing, sir.
You're obviously concerned about something, said Davis. The chief's eyes flicked to Volreich, then back to Reed. Is there something about the... other matter? I should get back to my desk, grumbled Volreich.
No, said Reed. Really, it's nothing. I guess I was just thinking that maybe we should get the analysts in on this.
There. He'd said it. If Davis agreed that showing the message to Lisa was fine, then Reed didn't have to feel guilty about it.
I don't want too many people involved, said Davis.
Clearly, muttered Volreich.
Reed's heart sank. Now it was worse than before. Davis had directly ordered him not to share the message or any words in it with anyone else.
But Chuck and Lisa have already seen some of the related messages, he said.
They've seen some, but there's no reason to show them everything, said Davis. And you know why. For now... we're going to keep information limited to as few people as possible. Even among the three of us, there are things you know that Yannick doesn't and vice versa. It's the only way to do this safely.
Volreich looked at Reed, then back at Davis.
What is in the part of the message you do want to show me?
GDR to demand ID at border entry. Davis quoted, that's sobering news.
It is.
Said Volreich.
Do they mean the diplomatic checkpoints? Dreilinden and Friedrichstrasse and those?
No one's allowed to cross the border anywhere else, said Reed, so I assume it's at the checkpoints, but
even that would be a violation of the Potsdam Agreement. Military and diplomatic officials are supposed to be able to travel freely in the city, even across sector borders. I mean, we're allegedly allies. The Soviet Union has been pushing the limits for years, but are they really going to push them this far? Turning their back on Potsdam would be the biggest change yet. Bigger than the wall, maybe. The Soviets wouldn't dare, said Davis. Or at least not if their fingerprints were on the orders, but if it's the GDR's doing, they could potentially get away with it. Russia's gone out of its way to brand the GDR as a distinct political entity, and maybe this is why. It's all been building toward a total closure of the border.
Or maybe they're opening the border again, said Volreich, and Reed was shocked to hear a note of emotion in his voice.
Maybe they will demand ID because the people crossing will be civilians. Maybe the city is uniting again.
He spoke with passion, and Reed realized that this rare show of emotion shouldn't shock him at all. Berlin was Yannick's city. He'd been born here and had returned as soon as the war was over. He probably had family in East Berlin. Almost everyone did. If there was even one glimmer of hope that the city might be reunited again, who wouldn't be emotional? Which is why it pained Reed so much to have to argue against Volreich's theory. Longshore chooses his words with precision. In this one, he doesn't call it a border crossing. He calls it a border entry. He had enough room to say border crossing or border traffic or even open border, but he said border entry, people entering East Germany. It doesn't say anything about people coming out.
Volreich sighed.
I know. I knew before you said it, but every now and then I allow myself to hope.
Every step they take toward closing the border leads to only two possible explanations, said Davis. One is that they're trying to keep their own people inside. East Germans are fleeing in massive numbers, and the GDR is doing everything they can to stop it. But the other explanation worries me even more. And they're not mutually exclusive. They might both be true. Maybe the East Germans have given up on the Potsdam Agreement completely. Maybe they're going to declare the Soviet sector of Berlin to be a fully autonomous nation, separate from the rest of the city and cut off from our ability to see what they're doing.
They could be gathering troops, said Volreich.
They could be, said Davis. There's nowhere in the world that the Soviet Union can get an army this close to vital Western territory. Cutting off our access could be a prelude to invasion, to war, to who knows what military action. He looked at Reed. Longshore is one of the only agents the CIA and BND still have over there. The only one, as far as I know, actually inside of the Stasi. He's the one I will have left if they go through with this border closure, and that makes him more vital than ever. We have to keep him safe, and that means we have to... He stopped abruptly.
Yannick, I believe it's time to excuse you.
Volreich looked displeased, but Reed supposed the man would rather leave than sit through another conversation full of exclusions and veiled secrets.
See what you can learn about this border issue, said Davis. Feel free to use anyone on the team you need. This is a priority, and we want to know everything we can about it before the GDR puts their plan into action.
Understood, said Volreich, though he still walked out in a cloud of wounded pride.
Reed closed and locked the door behind him, and Davis lowered his voice.
We need to protect Longshore, he said, and that means we have to find this double agent before he can discover our secrets, give up Longshore's identity, and blind us completely.
Reed nodded. I agree.
Then find that mole, said Davis,
or you'll be eating borscht for breakfast this time next week.
He sighed and looked back at the message.
I'll send word of this border business to Hogan in the State Department.
A nice way to remind them, double agent or not, that we're a vital link in the intelligence chain, gathering intel nobody else can get.
As for this stuff with Weiss, he frowned, staring at the words on the paper.
I want to know who I can trust, Wally. I can't run an intelligence office if I can't actually use anyone in it.
So I'll figure out who Weiss is, where he is, and everything else we can learn without letting him know that we're watching. We'll keep the others in the dark until we have something to tell them that won't instantly give everything away.
What about Frank? Asked Reed.
We're trusting him. Davis pondered that for a moment, then nodded. Yes, but not until after we find this Eric Gunther Anselm. If Anselm is the handler codenamed Vice, Frank will have to interact with him anyway. And if Frank is already a mole, our triple agent op is already ruined. Anselm will be our litmus test for Frank. If he bolts, we'll know Frank tipped him off because he's the only one who knew about it.
And nobody else, said Reed.
Chuck and Lisa have some of the other bits and pieces, but Eric Gunther Anselm is a whole new level of sensitive intel. Davis shook his head. No one else in the office can know anything about this, about Talon, Baker, Vice, none of it.
Reed felt himself deflate slightly. The ball was back in his court. If Lisa was going to find out about the code word, it would have to be because he told her himself. In what was now a direct violation of orders, Davis continued.
I wish there was some way to ask Longshore for clarification. For all I know, we're on the wrong track completely. Maybe Anselm isn't Vice and Longshore is pointing him out for some other reason. For all we know, it's another hint about where to find message 41. Does Anselm have it? But why would Longshore trust a stranger over us?
He closed his eyes and pinched the ridge of his nose. Maybe the next message will say more.
This, Reed realized, was the perfect opportunity to ask about the confirmation codes.
How did Davis send them? How much precisely could be communicated through him?
Lisa had told him to ask, but he still wasn't sure how much he trusted her. He waffled, then forced himself to make a clear decision.
What about the confirmation codes?
What about them? Asked Davis. Obviously, you can communicate with Longshore somehow. Is there any way we could send a message that way?
It's only one letter at a time, said Davis. Even if... He hesitated. No. There's no way.
Are you absolutely sure? This is my specialty, after all. Maybe there's something I could...
The method I use is sensitive, said Davis. I don't want to put anything at risk. If worse comes to worst, the method is on file in the State Department computers. So it won't die with me, but Hogan won't give access to anyone but the section chief.
And if the section chief changed, Reed realized, it would be because Davis was dead. And Vollreich was now the next in line to replace him.
5:22 p.m., West Berlin. Reed walked to the train station with his head down, thinking, what should he tell Lisa? He wanted to trust her, and a part of him knew that he'd be happier if he did, to open himself completely, to share everything, to tell himself that she was as innocent as he had always believed her to be. To tell himself, perhaps most important of all, that her feelings for him were pure, that their relationship was motivated by mutual interest and not the convenience of espionage. Another part of him, quiet and insidious, told him that he was a fool. He rode the C1 train from Rathaus Neukölln to Hermannplatz and transferred to the D. He sat in a bench near the right-hand window and settled in for the ride. Three stops before the ghost stations. The first stop was Schönleinstrasse, where a handful of new passengers trickled in. Reed ignored them, but one of them, a woman, sat behind him on the opposite bench and whispered softly, "Get off at Cottbusse." Reed recognized Lisa's voice instantly. "Take the B2 to Warschau." Reed forced himself not to turn around. He and Lisa had never contacted each other this close to the cabin, and he didn't know who else might be watching. He stared forward, pretending not to hear, and wondered, what did she want now?
He debated simply ignoring her, but decided the least he could do was to hear her out. Taking a different train was, in itself, still perfectly allowable. Kotbusator was the very next station, and when the train pulled to a stop, he stood up, turned, and followed the crowd out onto the platform. Most of the passengers exited here. With so many stations closed, this was the last transfer before the end of the line, and he lost sight of Lisa almost immediately. He followed the signs for the B2 and stood on the platform marked Richtung Warschau. Someone had scrawled over it in sloppy black paint, changing it to Richtung CCCP. There were a handful of other riders waiting with him, but he couldn't see Lisa. Maybe Lisa is Weiss, he told himself. Maybe I'm Baker. And our whole relationship has been Operation Talon. She's been bending me bit by bit toward the Stasi, and now she thinks I'm ready to meet her leaders. The thought left him feeling surprisingly peaceful. If this was Talon, then going along with it just made him a triple agent, like Frank was. He could talk to Lisa, learn what he could, and report back to Davis with a clear conscience. The B2 came, half full of people, and he stepped in and grabbed a strap on the top bar. The train rumbled through two more stations, but at the second one, Schlesisches Tor, it emptied completely. Reed stood alone, holding the strap in an empty train, and the conductor walked by.
Letzter Halt, he said.
Reed frowned. Last stop? What about Warschau?
It's on the other side of the Spree, said the conductor in broken English. A ghost station. We do not go there.
Reed stepped off onto the now empty platform and walked to the stairs. This station was raised instead of underground, and he caught a brief glimpse of the Spree River as he passed the windows. Lisa appeared as if out of nowhere and fell into step with him as he walked down the stairs to the street.
Follow me, she said. It's a short walk.
Where?
2 blocks up, number 10, Kuppernickerstrasse.
Reed nodded. Not a secret meeting with the Stasi then, unless Lisa and Davis were in it together. They exited the train station and Reed could see a small park to the northeast, and beyond it, a wide double-decker bridge that crossed the Spree River, bristling with regal arches and medieval towers. It was only about a block away, close enough for Reed to see the barriers that had gone up at the edge of it, barring anyone from crossing. Reed nodded toward it.
Another piece of history that managed to survive the war, the Oberbaum Bridge. That's the most gothic piece of architecture I've seen here yet.
It's a lie, said Lisa.
The bridge is barely 65 years old.
She turned away and led him to the left. Reed quickened his pace to catch up.
So, Davis wouldn't tell me about the confirmation codes.
He supposed he could tell her that much, at least.
And it would earn some trust to tell her that he'd tried.
Lisa nodded.
That's fine. I think I may have found a clue. I talked to Bettina.
She's an angel and smart as an owl, but she's only the secretary, so people ignore her. She was happy to chat with me.
I told her about you. Not by name, obviously. I just said I had a boyfriend and gossiped a bit about all the annoying little things he does. How you never wash your dishes until you don't have any clean ones left, just little things. Girl talk. Bettina says she doesn't have a boyfriend, though I think she does and just didn't want to tell me. But she did have quite a bit to say about Gordon Davis. Like taking care of a child, she says. For example, did you know that he calls his laundry lady every day?
Is that so strange? Asked Reed.
Even I have a laundry lady. What single man in the CIA doesn't?
Maybe, said Lisa. But what single man generates so much dirty clothing that he needs his laundry done every day?
Good point, said Reed. A lover, then?
Men with secret lovers don't call them every day from work, said Lisa. And men with no secrets do not pretend their lovers are laundresses.
She stopped in front of an old apartment building. He is not hiding his relationship with the woman, but she is obviously doing more than laundry. So he is definitely hiding something.
Reed looked at the number on the building, 10 Kopenickerstrasse.
You think he's sending her the confirmation codes, and she's passing them the longshore?
I think it's likely, yes, said Lisa, and opened the wrought iron gate to the building's inner courtyard. She lives in number 3512. Let's see if we can find her.
They walked into the courtyard and then through an arch at the back that led into a smaller courtyard, surrounded by a tall ring of walls and windows above them. They followed the next arch to a third courtyard, then slipped into a side door and climbed 5 flights of stairs. Apartment 3512 looked identical to every other door. Lisa straightened her jacket and knocked on the door.
An old German woman answered, gruff and impatient.
Gross Gott.
Hallo,
said Lisa, and proceeded to tell her in lilting, almost musical German that they were new in the neighborhood and someone had mentioned that she washed laundry. The old woman furrowed her brow at this, obviously angry, and demanded to know who. Lisa described someone generic, brushing it off as no big deal, but the woman only grew more agitated.
Ich mache keine Wäsche,
she kept repeating over and over. She didn't do laundry. This made Reed nervous. What if she really wasn't a laundry lady at all? 2 people showing up and asking about what was supposed to be only a cover story would look incredibly suspicious. He looked past her to a window beyond, seeing a small apartment balcony and what was very clearly a clothesline filled with shirts. He didn't have time to point it out before the old woman closed her door. He could hear her slide the latch close to lock it.
Was she just grumpy or was she lying to us? Reed asked.
Both, said Lisa. I asked around before we came here. She is definitely known as a laundry woman. But she certainly didn't want to talk about it with us.
She started walking slowly back to the stairs.
Maybe there is a message in the clothing itself. Maybe he hides something in the pockets or writes it under the collar, and she collects it that way. We could try to intercept the handoff when she gets them from Davis,
or we could just try to look at them here,
said Reed, not eager to raise the stakes even further by stealing.
I didn't get a good look at the shirts, but they're right outside.
Lisa paused, considering it.
Maybe can talk our way onto the balcony above her, she said, and started going up the stairs instead of down.
No good, said Reed, and Lisa stopped. The clothesline was too far back from the edge. The only way to get a clear view would be from the...
Oh, he froze, and then closed his eyes as the realization hit him. Oh, my word.
The river,
said Lisa, picking up instantly on the same line of thought. The only clear view of that laundry line is from the other side of the river in East Berlin.
It's a visual code, said Reed.
The 2 sides of the city can't talk to each other, but we can see everything.
She could write her message on a sign if she wanted and just let him read it.
It's got to be subtler than that, said Lisa, and she started back down the stairs. Maybe we can see her balcony from the courtyard.
They reached the ground level and stepped out into the wide open space at the base of the building. Beyond them was the river, at least 100 yards across, and on the far side was another open space.
Train tracks, said Lisa, staring across the water, and then she pointed to a large building slightly to the left. That is the Ostbahnhof, one of the biggest train stations in East Berlin. 100 trains pass through there in a day, maybe 1,000, and any passenger on any one of them could see these balconies.
Then whatever the code is, it's gotta be big, said Reed. Big enough to see from all the way over there.
If Longshore pulled out binoculars every time he rode the train, he'd look far too suspicious.
He turned and looked up at the side of the apartment, seeing row after row of windows and balconies. He backed up all the way to the edge of the courtyard, where a thin iron railing stopped him from falling straight into the water. He looked down. The building's foundations had been built directly into the river. He looked up, counted the floors, and identified the exact balcony of Davis's mysterious laundress. A line of white clothing billowed slightly in the breeze.
"Even the trousers are white," said Lisa, staring with him. "I have never seen Davis wear white trousers."
"You sneaky bastard," Reed muttered. "Those aren't Davis's actual clothes. They're Morse code. Look at it. Shirt, shirt, trousers, shirt, dash, dash, dot, dash.
That is Q,"
said Lisa, frowning as she recalled her Morse.
"What was today's confirmation code?"
"Q," said Reed. "I suppose it's possible the dots and dashes could be reversed, but that's today's code, and that's too big of a coincidence to ignore." He looked at his watch, 6:27. "If we hang around, we can be here when she changes it to tomorrow's code. How consistent is Davis in the timing of the calls? Every night at 7?
"Bettina didn't say," said Lisa.
Reed looked around and found a row of benches. "Do you have any other plans?"
"I can think of nothing I'd rather do,"
said Lisa, smiling slightly. They sat on one of the benches as if they were nothing more than two lovers on a date. They looked out across the water, huddled together in the October chill, and only occasionally glanced up to see if the code had changed. Reed watched East Berlin with quiet fascination, so similar to West Berlin that they looked from a distance completely indistinguishable. The same people, the same styles, the same habits. They weren't sister cities, but a single organism, cleaved in half and wincing from the pain of it, like the endless ache of a phantom limb. The more he looked, though, the more he saw evidence of one major glaring difference. Grenzers. The border troops were everywhere, watching for runaways, or planning out avenues of attack. 7 o'clock came and went without a change in the code. 7:30. Other people came and went, watching the city or murmuring softly. By 8 it was almost too dark to see, but most of the windows had lights inside, including 3512.
"You could use lights to pass Morse code as well," Reed thought idly. "If you had enough of them in a row, 5, so you could do numbers as well as letters. But no, because turning lights on and off wouldn't be enough. You'd need 3 states, dot, dash, and nothing. If you can't distinguish a signal from an empty space, it doesn't work."
"I'm hungry," said Lisa.
Reed looked at his watch, barely visible in the moonlight.
8:19, wow.
He looked back up at the clothesline, but it still said Q.
"You want to give up? We might be wrong about all of this."
"No," said Lisa, standing up. "Stay and watch. I'll get us something."
"It's dark," said Reed, standing with her.
"Are you sure you're safe?"
She gave him a disappointed smirk, and he remembered how easily she'd disarmed him the other night. She was a trained field agent. She'd be fine. He sat down again, still watching, and at 8:30, Lisa returned with a pair of sausages and thick, crusty rolls. She held them out, one in each hand.
"Vice first or bratwurst?" asked Reed.
"Nobody eats vice first for dinner," said Lisa, "and certainly not in a roll."
She handed him the bratwurst, and he stared at it.
"Vice,"
said Reed, struck by the sudden memory of message 44. He wanted to tell her about Longshore's latest code word. Either she was innocent, or he could play the triple agent like Frank. Either way, telling her could earn her trust and give Reed more information to work with. He made his decision. He gestured with the bratwurst.
"That was the 6th word today. Vice."
"So
We will write,
said Lisa, covering her mouth as she chewed.
The sixth word is always German, and that must mean something. If Longshot is my old partner Mercury, then this is his way of telling me where to find message 41. In a dead drop, I assumed, but...
She shook her head.
We had 3, maybe 4 different dead drops that could conceivably be called white. He needs to send us another clue to help narrow it down.
Can't we just check them all? Asked Reed.
We will be lucky if we can check any, said Lisa, and pointed at the lights across the water.
They're over there. Reed took a bite of his sausage and thought about the wall. Nearly 45 minutes later, he glanced up to see someone rearranging the clothesline.
Kind of late for laundry, he said. Kind of late for Davis to be calling from the office, said Lisa.
The old woman worked swiftly in the light from her windows, but all she did was take down a single shirt, the one farthest to the left. She went inside and closed the sliding door, but left the lights on.
Dash dot dash, said Reed. That's K or R if I have it backwards.
Then tomorrow we wait for a Longshore message, said Lisa. If the confirmation code is a K or an R, we'll know we found Davis's system.
For all the good that does us, said Reed. We still can't use it to talk to Longshore, and there's no way he can use it to talk back to us.
All information is useful, said Lisa, standing up. Even if we don't know how yet. They walked out to the street and from there back to the train station. Reed stopped in a pool of shadows away from any street lamps and pulled Lisa in close for a kiss. She kissed him back eagerly, her tongue brushing gently at his lips, and then pulled away.
I can't come home with you tonight, she said.
I know. She kissed him again, and then they stepped away from each other. He went into the train station and she disappeared into the shadows. Reed rode the B2 back to Côte-Beau-Sautoir and transferred to the D. The train was practically empty as he passed through the ghost stations, and he shivered involuntarily at the sepulchral feeling of it. He got out at Walterstrasse, walked home, and heard his phone ringing.
What?
He checked his watch. It was nearly 10:30. The phone rang again, and he fumbled with his key to get in. He raced across the living room and picked up the receiver just in time.
Hello? Damn it, Reed. Where the hell have you been?
It was Chief Davis, practically shouting into the phone.
I was on a date, said Reed, scrambling to find his bearings. What's going on?
It's the checkpoints. Wally, just like Longshore told us. They stopped Alan Leitner at the border, the damn chief of mission, and turned him back. Kennedy screaming, the State Department's barely keeping their heads on, and General Clay sent a whole damn military parade through Checkpoint Charlie just to prove we couldn't be bullied. And you're out stooping some German girl in a beer garden bathroom?
I didn't know, shouted Reed. I didn't hear anything about this. I'm here now, though. What do you need me to do?
I don't know if there's anything you can do, said Davis. I'm just trying to find everyone in the cabin and make sure we're all alive. He paused just for a second, and Reed knew exactly what that pause meant. Reed had disappeared in the middle of a crisis, and now Davis was suspicious. Where were you? Reed told the same half-truth.
I was on a date.
So you said, where?
Do you think I was talking to the Stasi chief?
I think it shouldn't be this hard for you to tell me where you were tonight.
It was an Italian restaurant, said Reed, and said the first name that popped into his head. A Kalamata, that's Greek. I ordered pasta.
What was the girl's name?
Anna,
last name.
For Pete's sake, chief, last name! Gorman,
said Reed. It was the name of his landlord. He spun out more details, lying as fast as he could, listening to the words coalesce from nothing on his lips like sugar in a cotton candy machine.
Anna Gorman. She's a little young for me, honestly, barely 20 years old, so I didn't want to tell you.
damn it, Wally!
Reed heard Davis breathing, half a gasp and half a sigh. I'm sorry, Reed. You know I trust you.
It's a hard time, said Reed, wincing at the blandness of his own words. It's okay.
Have you heard from Lisa? Asked Davis. Reed tensed, but of course Davis would have been trying to reach her too, and wouldn't have been able to. There was no reason for anyone to suspect she and Reed had been together.
No, sir, said Reed. Is she gone too?
And Harald Wagner. Reed shook his head, gritting his teeth, cursing himself for lying to his chief, but having no other way to get out of this.
Lisa has a boyfriend. She might be there.
You're supposed to be following her.
Her boyfriend is clean, said Reed, trying to think faster than he spoke. When she's with him, she's fine.
You don't know that.
I can't just live under her bed, snapped Reed. If you want 24-hour surveillance, we need a whole team, not just me.
He shook his head at his own outburst, knowing that he'd just made several bluffs stacked on top of each other and praying that Davis didn't call any of them. The silence on the phone dragged on, far longer than Reed was comfortable with.
I know, said Davis at last.
He paused again, then,
what about Harald? I told you before, I don't know him well.
Nobody does, said Davis, and paused. But if he was going to say anything else about Harald, he decided against it. Keep your ears up and your eyes open and your bloody gun loaded for all the good it will do you. We're on the brink of war, and you saw how the last one ended. We don't shoot bullets anymore, Wally. We drop atomic bombs.
Monday, October 23rd, 1961, 7 a.m., East Berlin. The train stopped. Reed jerked forward, nearly falling off a seat as the train lurched to a sudden halt. The other passengers did the same.
Scheiße, somebody muttered.
They were halfway between two ghost stations in an unlit tunnel. Reed looked out the window at the dull gray wall barely a foot or two away.
Was ist passiert? Asked a man by the door.
I don't know,
said Reed, forgetting in his shock that he should answer in German.
You are American?
Asked the man. He wore a blue suit with a shabby brown hat.
Yeah.
They closed the border last night, said a woman across the aisle.
Are we trapped?
My brother was trapped,
said another man. He wore a pair of coveralls.
He was out late drinking with his friends when the wall went up. They won't let him come back.
Another woman wailed.
We're not trapped, said Reed, trying to sound more certain than he felt.
They blocked one diplomat at the border and it almost started a war. They wouldn't dare block an entire train full of people.
He's an American,
muttered a man in the back and then raised his voice so that everyone could hear him.
He's probably military. He's probably why they stopped the train.
I'm not with the military, said Reed, and I'm not a target. I'm a businessman, just like all of you.
It was the CIA standard line, though Reed felt completely transparent as he said it.
Our city is not a battleground for your pissing contest,
the man snapped. The door at the front of the train car opened and a man from the next car relayed a message from the driver. There was a problem with the track and they had to wait.
See,
said Reed, trying to convince himself as much as anybody else.
It's nothing sinister.
The man in the doorway looked at him, then looked back at the Germans and told them to pass the message to the next car. He started to close the door again, but Reed stood up.
Wait!
He was too flustered to think in German.
What does the conductor say? Der Fahrer. Do we just wait here? Can we walk out?
The section of the track connects to Alexanderplatz,
said the man in the hat.
Four other train lines intersect with it.
we will be run over and killed.
Back the other way then, said the woman. No one uses that track but the D train.
It's miles, said Reed.
You wouldn't walk miles to find freedom?
Demanded the man in the back.
The driver says we need to stay calm and wait, said the man in the doorway. Workers are coming to fix it. Tell the other cars.
He closed the door and Reed and the other passengers looked at each other. No one moved. Finally, the man on the coveralls grumbled and moved toward the back of the train car.
I'll do it.
He forced the door open and relayed the message to the next group of people.
We should get out and walk, said the woman. Back to Folterstrasse. It's better than waiting here.
That's miles, Reed repeated. Through pitch-black tunnels and three ghost stations. And they're patrolled by the GDR. If we stay here, they know we're West German. If they catch you out in the tunnels, they might think you're a runner trying to escape from the East.
They could do the same to us here, said an older man. They could collect us all for processing, take us in for questioning, and then never give us back. Political hostages.
We don't know that, said the man in the hat.
We don't know who's coming for us either,
said the angry man, speaking loudly as he walked toward them.
Workers, he says. Are they our workers? Would they let West German workers into East German tunnels? This close to Alexanderplatz? Never!
This close to Alexanderplatz, said Reed. An obstacle on the tracks will affect dozens of trains.
They'll fix it in a couple of minutes at most.
Unless the obstacle only affects our track, said the woman. If we are not allowed to fix it, and they do not have to fix it, we could be here for hours.
The man in the coveralls came back.
The passengers in the next wagon are even more nervous than we are,
the old man snorted.
The man from the front car probably said the same thing about us.
How long do we wait? Asked the woman.
I'm willing, but for how long? 10 minutes? 30 minutes? Do we sit here for an hour before we do something?
The door at the front of the car opened again, and this time it was the conductor himself.
Achtung!
He said loudly, and made an announcement in tense, fearful German. He had received an explanation on the radio. The delay was being caused by a body on the tracks. The passengers gasped. The conductor continued, walking the length of the car as he urged them to be patient and wait for help. He reached the back of the car and started working on the door. The man in the hat started to speak, and the conductor stopped him.
Keine Fragen.
He opened the door and stepped into the next car.
Achtung!
The door closed behind him.
A body on the tracks, said the woman.
A refugee, maybe, said the angry man. Someone tried to flee to the west.
He looked blankly at the floor, then shot Reed a furious scowl.
One oppressor for another.
He turned and stalked back to his seat. Nobody asked about getting out after that. The passengers waited in silence, checking their watches and staring at the floors or the windows or the doors. The conductor had gone back to the front of the train, but the look on his face warned any other questions away. Reed closed his eyes, controlling his breathing, feeling the walls and the tunnel and the full weight of the city, of the entire GDR and the Soviet Union, pressing in on him like the ruins of an earthquake. He felt trapped and short of breath.
Stop panting, said the man in the coveralls. We have plenty of air. You will make yourself sick.
Reed slowed his breath further. The conductor announced that he was turning off the lights to save power, and the train was plunged into blackness. Minutes ticked away into nothing.
How will it come when it comes?
Reed found himself looking at the windows and the doors, expecting at any minute to see Stasi officers appear in the glass, shining flashlights in their faces and hauling them to the surface to some interrogation where they could be debriefed and deprogrammed and disappeared. The other passengers, barely more than shadows in the darkness, kept looking at him, probably still thinking that this was somehow his fault or that his status as an American would get him special treatment they wouldn't receive. And they were right. The Germans would eventually, probably, get to go home. As soon as they discovered Reed was a CIA spy, they'd throw him into the deepest hole they had. A light flickered through the window, distant but shocking after so long in the dark. Reed's heart quickened and he gripped the bar tightly. What was it? Were they coming? The lights in the train car came back on, one by one, humming and buzzing as they struggled awake. Reed looked at the doors, both at the ends of the car and on the sides, leading out into the tunnel, but nobody opened them. Abruptly, the train lurched forward, once, twice, three times, building up speed. The woman across the aisle closed her eyes and started praying. Reed waited until they passed through Alexanderplatz, until he recognized that they were still in the right tunnel, instead of rerouted into some East German detour, before finally closing his eyes and relaxing. The train pulled into Moritzplatz, the first stop after the ghost stations, and as soon as the doors opened, the passengers poured out like water from a broken